you can't get more local than one-on-one at someone's front door.
Right.
And so that's just in our DNA.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I love getting the chance to speak with Matt Morrison, Executive Director of Working America, which is the community organizing arm of the AFL-CIO. They reach 3.5 million working Americans, so it's a very important group. And Matt's been at Working America for a long time, first as political director and now as ED, so he knows a lot. And for a long time, Working America has been thoughtfully testing and measuring their interactions with their membership, learning as much as they can about what people care about and how they can reach them most effectively through direct communications, at the doors, and digitally. It was a good conversation, one well worth listening to. So after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Matt Morrison with Working America.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Could you introduce yourself and give me a quick biography?
Absolutely. I'm Matt Morrison. I'm the current executive director of Working America, the community organizing arm of the AFL-CIO. For the 10 years preceding this job, which I got about a year and a half ago, I was the political director here. I also have a background working in presidential politics and the labor movement and on Capitol Hill. So none of those qualifies one to be what I think friends will call a self-taught quant, someone who has tried to center experimentation and measurement at the work of the most decidedly old-fashioned organizing approach possible, going door-to-door and talking to people face-to-face. So that's a little bit about kind of my personal background. I'd say a little bit about the organizational background might also be useful. Working America was a recognition of the labor movements back in 2003 that we didn't have the density we needed to affect outcomes in races, both at electoral and legislative levels. And yet there were all these people, former union members' neighbors, who agreed with us ideologically. By going door to door, in organizing people at their door without the barrier of having to find a collective bargained work environment or organize their own environment, we essentially turned the funnel upside down. We opened the gates for more people who were ideologically aligned with the labor movement to join and stay engaged with us.
So what was the founding story for this part of the AFL? Who was the impetus and how did it all happen?
Yeah, I mean, so I can tell you the PG-13 rated version of it, because it's the labor movement after all.
Real people.
Yeah, yeah. So the environment at the time, you have to keep in mind, was following McCain-Feingold, where up to that point, two things. One, Democrats had lost some but won some, but you had George Bush's election selection, depending on how you name it, and then just the onslaught of the 2002 post-9/11 election. And that dramatically shifted the country's politics rightward. Add to that, McCain-Feingold had this really profound effect in as much as all of the investment that party apparatus and others would always go to the labor movement and say, hey, write us a check, do this piggy bank thing. That got bottled up. It could no longer go to the party. And you know, at that time, you saw the advent of 527s and all types of kind of creative political engagement, everything up to Senator X is a such and such, call his office and tell him how you feel about him type of thing. And so there was this kind of fertile moment, if you will. At that moment, the founding director of Working America is a woman by the name of Karen Nussbaum. She's probably best known for her work as the founding director of the women's advocacy organization 925, which focused on administrative and secretarial staff, but then later became the inspiration for the movie 9 to 5. And Karen, as a longtime community organizer, saw this opportunity to say, all right, what if we bring people who aren't full-fledged union members but share a demand, share a need, share a set of economic concerns into the fold? And one mechanism for doing that is also to exploit the political convenience, if you will, the political demand. And so we constructed this notion of Working America that allowed the labor movement to extend its reach to people who didn't have a traditional union membership, but also allowed Working America to be an organization that advocates for these members, not just a transactional actor as it related to politics. And that's defined our ethos ever since.
So help me understand the relationship between Working America and the AFL. I mean, obviously, labor unions are recognized in the law in particular ways. How does funding work? How do they work side by side? How do you manage that relationship?
Sure. So Working America is not the AFL-CIO.
Right.
We're the community organizing arm of the AFL-CIO. And so structurally speaking, our mission is to focus not on union members, but on the other people in the same community. So at that kind of jurisdictional level, there's pretty easy alignment. Obviously, ideologically, we are identical. We believe in the same policy positions. We understand the imperative of expanding collective bargaining rights, etc. At that point, both mechanically and ideologically, there's clear alignment. Operationally, we do a couple of things that I think really make the integration seamless. You're sitting in the AFL-CIO national headquarters, which is some testament to how we function as just a kind of collaborative part of the Federation when it comes to issue advocacy. There's a set of legal structures that we follow when it comes to electoral advocacy, so we try to be very deliberate about that. In terms of funding and financing, the work is funded by a combination of contributions from the Federation, labor allies, members, which is, I think, an underappreciated aspect of the work, that is working class people who don't have a CBA saying, I want to pony up and make this a cause. And there's some wealthy folks, foundations, et cetera, who also contribute some portion of the funding.
So how big is Working America? How do you, in two senses, in the number of people that are part of it, members mm-hmm. and otherwise, and then in staff?
Sure. So right now we have three offices spread around the country. And by offices, I mean organizing offices that are actively going out into the communities. We've got a standing office in the Minnesota Twin Cities, a standing office actually here in D.C., and a standing operation in North Carolina. We also have programmatic offices, which are smaller. So as the cycle expands and contracts, we shift resources, staff resources, to different parts of the country. At our peak, in, say, a campaign cycle, we'll have as many as 1,000 people on staff, 15 to 20 offices running. And in between those times, we continue to engage those people who we engage during the course of the election. The activists get more of an individualized engagement, and the digital engagement also continues to reach a lot of folks. The staff complement varies depending on the application in the moment, but where we really see the enduring impact is our ability to continue to influence the roughly 3.5 million members. We do an enormous amount of clinical measurement, both in cycle and long term, and we measure.
What does that mean to you, clinical measurement?
So you take the traditional statistical design, randomized populations, and you measure what your treatment effect is from administering any number of treatments, whether it's through digital engagement, community-level organizing, other types of advertising, or face-to-face contact.
What can you tell me about that? 3.5 million people is a lot of people.
It is.
It's also, who are those people? Where are they geographically? Where are they politically? Who makes up that contingent?
The demographic composition is slightly dated, but it stands up to voter file analysis. Every cycle we would survey membership, and what we find is that around 20% are non-white, 80% are white, although that racial composition has been shifting steadily less white and more diverse as we do more organizing in places like Arizona, North Carolina, Georgia. The demography of the working class is different. The historic footprint is really big in what's referred to as the Blue Wall states, but there's also places like Oregon where there's 300,000 working America members. Florida is 80,000 working America members. And so there are some unexpected places where we've just had occasion to engage in community level organizing, where you have that footprint. In terms of other demographic attributes, around a third of those members are weekly churchgoers, a third are gun owners, although only a fraction of those gun owners are NRA members. We know this obviously from survey data. The partisan makeup is actually a little bit confusing because you have states like Pennsylvania where we're pretty overrepresented, and your partisan registration so drives your partisan identification, but it doesn't drive your voting behavior for a fair number of voters. And so I would say if you think of kind of a true Democrat or a Democratic leaner, you probably earn around 40% of the working America membership are Democrats or lean Democrats, around 20 to 25% are Republicans / lean Republicans, and the rest are undeclared independents, etc. I would say as a point of pride, when we do post-election surveys, what we tend to find is that amongst the membership who votes, and depending on the election cycle, that varies, but we're normally talking between 60 and 80% of that membership block voting, we normally get around 2-1 or better for our endorsed candidates. Often Democrats, but not exclusively so.
That sounds like a really important part of American politics, where working America sits.
Mm-hmm.
What is your own view about how to best serve that membership with policy and so on? What are you promoting?
Since we started, we've had closing in on around 12 million individualized conversations with people. Mm-hmm. And so from having that volume and the longitudinal value of all of that data, you can track changes in opinion by demography, segment, geography, et cetera. Mm-hmm. What seems to be driving people? If you had to name it as an issue, a campaign issue, it'd be healthcare. But when you start to dissect the qualitative feedback, so one of the things we do is capture notes from the field every night, and then on a weekly basis, we compile that. So we have that for 15 years and running. Mm-hmm. What we're seeing is that there's a well-documented graph by Economic Policy Institute that shows the decoupling of wages and productivity. So as productivity has increased for the last 45 years, wages have more or less stayed stagnant. What we are observing is that people are trying to figure out how they're going to make ends meet. And so if that comes in the form of anxiety around a $20,000 hospitalization bill, anxiety around having to work until you die for retirement, anxiety around where you live determines what the caliber of educational opportunity your kid gets. Like, it's all anxiety driven around a lack of economic confidence. When we think about what our mission is and how we provide advocacy in that context, the first thing is you got to educate people, because one of the challenges we all live in, and this is particularly acute in any type of politicized environment, is that the traditional channels of the way people gain information about their civic society have altered and in some instances broken down altogether. There's a lot of heady talk about, communication has been democratized. Anyone can create a wave on Twitter or what have you. And what we find more fundamentally is that most social media outlets tend to have relatively siloed adherents. And so they're really good inside of their echo chamber, but there's not much effect beyond that. There's enormous predictive power in people's partisan behavior depending on how they consume information. So those who consume fewer sources of information tend to be far more conservative in their political orientation. Those who have a more diverse diet or something that requires more personal investment tend to be more progressive.
So to be concrete about that, if you listen to Fox News all day long, you're in that bubble, it's going to be hard to move you, and you're going to be conservative typically.
Well, I mean, let's take it a step further than that. And this goes to the mechanics of where the electorate is. If you live in central Pennsylvania, if you live in central Ohio, which is a great example, I think Sinclair owns 7 out of the 11 broadcast properties in central and southwestern Ohio. And if you are television dependent, so you're not even in the Fox news bubble, you're watching Ohio State updates, then you also live in an environment where the number of newspapers has been cut, you know, it's been decimated quite literally.
And then owned by the right wing.
Exactly. Yeah. And so your capacity to get content is pretty limited to what you're getting from the local broadcast outlet. We ask people often at the doors, what's your primary source of political information and who you're voting for? And then when you cross-tab that, what you see is something in the order of magnitude of around a 30-point marginal shift, depending on if people are television dependent versus if they have a more diverse news diet. That's huge. And if you can start to shift how people consume information, then you get that type of structural advantage. The right wing has done this very methodically. I think it's only more recently that we've started thinking about the structural advantage of gaining communication superiority.
So we were talking about what kind of policy would you like to get through for your folks and for folks like them?
Sure.
What are the top pieces of agenda?
There's a couple of things that we see consistently rise to the top. On healthcare, the number one concern is affordability and access. Access plays out particularly differently in some of the smaller communities that we're working in. The unfinished business of the Affordable Care Act is cost containment, and a lot of the access issues are driven by local political impediments. You know, Kentucky, for example, was actually really on the cutting edge of deploying community clinics into underserved communities, many of the same places that are now racked by the opioid epidemic. Bevin has worked pretty aggressively to undermine many of those clinics, so you're not seeing the same type of resource deployment into the places where there's the highest need. That type of politicized impediment is something that, you know, we're squarely able to address through the political demand process. We don't lobby, I should note. So our capacity to affect the agenda is driven by creating public demand. But it works. If you look at Greensboro, North Carolina, is a great story for us. We started there back in 2012 and have since been just a steady presence. And so you take the tens of thousands of members that we've organized and maybe the 200,000 unique individuals that we've had face-to-face conversations with, and from that you call around 800 or so committed activists, people who, you know, they're not constantly storming city council, but they're engaged. They're picking up the phone when you ask them to make calls, that type of thing. And we packed City Hall both there and in Winston-Salem in the middle of the week. And keep in mind, these small towns, especially the ones that have oddier elections, tend to be the least representative of the populations they're governing. And so when you pack a City Hall and demand a municipal minimum wage of $15 an hour, and that was the first time in the South that that had been done, you're changing the economic floor of the entire region. And so if you have around 6% or so of the local workforce employed in local government, then you can actually track what your long-term effect is in shifting the wage floor that all other employers have to meet. So wages, access, and affordability of healthcare. And then our longer-term objective, quite frankly, is that there should be a lot more bargaining power for working people in this country. Union cards are a central way that that gets done. Going back to the Employee Free Choice Act fight, we were able to generate a lot of general public support around something like that. And that support didn't just go away. And so even while the labor law reform approaches weren't successful, the demand and who those individuals are still exists and are still looking for some solution that fits that anxiety.
On a national level, a lot of those goals align more closely with the Democratic Party than the Republican Party, pretty clearly.
Sure.
At least at this time and place, right? And we saw in the 2016 election, we saw a big swing in working class America, especially small towns, rural towns, towards Trump and towards the Republicans. What's the lens that you bring to that to move those people back the other way in order to get the kind of policies you're talking about passed on a national level?
So, you know, I've talked a little bit about this media desert. Our strategic approach is the best way to close a knowledge gap is to tell people stuff. And so it's not that complicated. We show up at people's doors. Once they sign up, then we keep them engaged through digital mechanisms. And what you see is this long-term shift in how people value things. And so you take something like government investment, which tends to be an ideological fault line that divides someone from self-identifying as a Democrat versus a Republican. And if you take it out of the abstract and you make it the campaign in Roanoke, Virginia, in southwestern Virginia, as we did following the 2017 election, about the importance of Medicaid expansion as expanding coverage for 40,000 people in that region of the state, the attendant job growth and economic security that that portends, then that winds up shifting how people hear that. So it doesn't, it's not perceived as, oh, that's the Democratic thing. It's perceived as, oh, that's the thing that who in their right mind is going to take to the microphone and argue against that concept. It's easy to demonize Obamacare and death panels, but hey, we're paying taxes that West Virginians are getting, and we could have 40,000 more people covered here.
So it sounds like your strategy is a lot around localizing things, making them very specific, and using that to navigate past some of the reflexes that people have based on politicization. Is that right?
I mean, in a way, like, you can't get more local than one-on-one at someone's front door.
Right.
And so that's just in our DNA.
How well do you think this kind of, some people call it deep canvassing, or this repeated staying in touch with people, how well does that work? You've been measuring it. You've been paying attention to how to understand the metrics around something like that. How well does it work for you?
Well, yeah, I love the deep canvassing. I love it in all sincerity because, one, it popularized something that I think had been a longstanding misapplication or misconception of what canvass really can be. So many of us have been on campaigns where we go and do that kind of knock and drag, go vote for, you know, Joe. That's what people perceive canvass to be. And so it's this kind of low quality, low tech interaction. Our organizing model, I think, has long adhered to a lot of the same principles of deep canvassing, where you're not trying to convince someone of something. You're trying to let them disarm in for themselves where they fit and go through a process of self-rationalization. When you look at the metrics behind this approach that begins with respecting where you want to start the conversation rather than what I presume you want, I wish I knew the mechanism, that the causal mechanism, but I'm able to measure the impact. And what we see is a few things. One, or to put this in the simplest terms possible, and especially understanding, kind of, you know, you've got a relatively elite audience of well-informed politicos. If you look at metrics on how many votes one may gain from a traditional approach to this type of individualized organizing and repeated contact, what you tend to see is something that is around a third of the vote gain that we generate from our approach towards the work. And because we've been constantly building and testing and learning even more about what we do, we keep stacking those Legos on top of each other. And so if we keep doing this right, then right now, for every dollar that you would invest in a conventional political program, you get around $3 of value from a Working America program. If we keep doing this right, then by the 2020 election, that's going to be $5 to $6 of value. Let's think about it less in terms of the value. Let's think of it in terms of the vote. If what we are all thinking about is the imperative of changing our politics, I actually use that phrase intentionally because there's a justifiable obsession with unseating Donald Trump and beating him at the ballot box. But Donald Trump, he's the best carnival barker that's been put forward for what has been a long-term trend.
He's a symptom.
Exactly. And so if you want to defeat Trumpism, the concept, the ideology, then what we see needing to be done is people need to see themselves in society and in politics and the economy in a more connected way. And so measurably, bit by bit, our strategy is yielding more short-term needs in terms of votes. But long-term, we're seeing changes in the levels of participation in politics, the levels in partisan preference in politics are changing long-term as a result of these contacts.
When I hear that you're doing that with 3.5 million people, that's encouraging. Why can't we do that with 35 million people? How do you get it to even more? Are you, like, what's the trajectory for your membership? Is it stable? Are you trying to grow it? What's the prospects for becoming even a greater force out there?
There's a testing protocol that we're trying to bring to bear. 3.5 million is plenty big to manage. And
that's a lot of people to talk to.
Address. Yeah. And I don't pretend that we speak to all of these people all the time. Like that's, I would actually be interested in knowing, like, if you asked all 3.5 million, are you a Working America member? How many would know? Oh, yeah, I am.
Probably a lot of them wouldn't because they're probably members of lots of things.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. Or actually, no. Share Progress did an analysis of our membership file and compared it to that of most of the progressive community. One of the things they found is that 90% of Working America members actually are not represented on anyone else's membership list.
And is that very different than, say, NARAL has this overlaps with environmental groups, overlaps with Move On or something? Are you sort of an outlier in that, or are the circles not very overlapping in general?
Well, certainly we are an outlier, and so I don't know other people's membership analysis as well, but essentially much of the progressive infrastructure is built around activists, that is, people who are inclined to engage. Our organizing model allows us to get to people who are otherwise sitting back on their sofa watching the game, kind of tending to the kids. I think a useful way to consider this is what Tucker Carlson, dare I say his name, gets, what, 3.5 million viewers. Rachel Maddow gets, what, 2.8 million viewers. Anderson Cooper is
probably not a lot of overlap between those two.
Maybe a little bit more than you think, but Anderson Cooper maybe another million. So even if we stack all of that together, and the highest rated shows on each of those networks, what you're talking about is somewhere in the ballpark of, you know, 8 million people on the high end. Now, in an electorate where we had 140 million people vote 2 years ago, like, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit sitting out there of people who aren't the politicized. Yeah. And so our organizing model allows us to go and get to the non-politicized relatively consistently. The interaction itself is not the same thing as having a strong ideological identity. I am an environmental fighter, and therefore I joined the Sierra Club. I am a women's health advocate, and therefore I fund Planned Parenthood. It is... I'm working class, and yeah. it's less tangible.
It's not quite an identity, but it is also clear from studies post the election that this was a very pivotal group in very pivotal states in electing Republicans and electing Trump, and it swung. How do you recommend talking to this group to move them your way?
There's two dimensions to this. One, we actually need to think about who this group is in a far more critical way than I think we've had chance to. There are a lot of people of color, voters of color, who left the electorate. And when we interview them, we see something that sounds a whole lot like the white working class voters who swung so decisively from Obama towards Trump. This one woman named Carol from Columbus, African-American woman, she got laid off in her 50s and hasn't been able to find work. She says, does it even matter?
Politics.
Yeah.
Yeah. You hear that a lot if you're canvass. Why does it matter which way? They don't care about me anyway, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And so you have that as a sentiment, but you also have a diversity of other sentiments out there in the electorate. But I think that probably best describes the people who've done dramatically different things. And so what we do is we start by saying, well, you know, tell me about what's going on in your life. Tell me about how you're affording healthcare. Tell me about how you afford housing, et cetera. And as soon as you center the conversation around listening and then start to connect dots for how policymakers make decisions connected to their interests, those of us who have the privilege of being college educated, well-informed, kind of comfortable in, you know, urban enclaves, et cetera.
Executive directors of big groups.
Exactly, exactly. We have a worldview and ideology that some of us were born into, but quite frankly, we all developed because we got information and had life experiences. And if you bring someone that life experience that they may not have otherwise had by connecting dots, then they start to form an ideology. To your earlier question of kind of what's the trajectory, we're testing along the way. There's no reason that there shouldn't be, instead of 3.5, 35 million Working America members, but you got to figure it out. You got to figure out what gets people invested and attached. You got to fund it, which is not an insignificant consideration. And you can't just be partisan.
This is a group that a lot of them are not natively partisan, and they're sitting in a persuadable universe or leaning one way or the other, right, it sounds like.
You know, I would actually argue, and I know this goes against conventional wisdom, that the vast majority of Americans are quite persuadable, both in terms of their partisan allegiance, but also whether or not they should participate. I know this not just from kind of speculating and guessing, but we've run in the past 10 years around 150 randomized clinical tests. We've also done a couple of thousand different regression analyses. what we tend to see is that people, yeah, they go home to their partisan camps, but outside of that moment, the vast majority aren't thinking about, like, normal people don't think about this stuff. And when you're not thinking about the stuff, you know, if I were to start talking to you, I don't know you particularly well, but I presume that you're not an aficionado of Caribbean sugarcane extraction techniques. Maybe you are, but if I educate
you. I don't rank myself super high on that particular knowledge area. Correct.
But I mean, so imagine you get like a little bit of information right. And you're like, oh, wow, I really do prefer this different technique for making my rum. It really is just that.
Right.
That's straightforward.
If you have nothing in that area, you can update your preferences pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even if you have a little something in that area because you particularly like a dark rum, a clear rum, whatever. I don't know how this got to rums, but I think I probably took it there. Your opinion can be shaped in dramatically different ways.
How does Working America intersect with sort of presidential primary politics that are in place right now? The Democrats have over a score of candidates, and they vary quite a bit on some of the issues that are of interest to you, as you've stated, and also in their theoretical capacity to win, and also, I'm sure, in the preferences of your membership.
Mm-hmm.
How do you play that? Do you endorse in a primary? Have you in the past? What's your plans?
We follow the AFL-CIO endorsement in presidential races, and the AFL-CIO traditionally waits until much of the process is sorted before they engage in an endorsement. The Federation, in a very smart move, I think about a year and a half ago, endorsed an initiative towards independent political power because, quite frankly, you see within our members and with a broader community that there are folks who, you know, kind of pox in all their houses, and it's more important that the institutional buy-in and agenda have enduring support. So we won't be endorsing ahead of the nominating contest in all likelihood.
Is it something that you query your membership on an ongoing basis about?
That's right.
What do you see?
The winner so far is no one. People aren't paying attention.
People are not paying attention or waiting to see who they like?
They're just not well informed yet. I mean, so let's actually segment this out because I think this is actually a really interesting distinction. Obviously, with a membership this large, we are able to look at what are primary voters, Democratic primary voters saying versus who are more tuned in, more likely to have an opinion versus kind of that swing voting population that we need to prevail upon in Pennsylvania where there's 500,000 Working America members.
And kind of an important state.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Democratic primary voters, when we've interviewed them in Iowa, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Virginia, have one guiding principle: who can beat Donald Trump? Now, it's fascinating to watch how that gets manifested, and a lot of it is whoever my favorite candidate is therefore the best to beat Donald Trump.
I've noticed that phenomenon quite a bit.
Yeah.
It's perplexing to me sometimes, but yes.
Yeah, but I mean, no matter who the—
But there's a pragmatism in the Democratic electorate right now around this important question.
Yeah, and I mean, and folks are more than willing to consider multiple candidates. The thing they want is not ideological adherence. They want to beat Donald Trump. And that's consistent from a majority of Democratic primary voters. Another consistent through line from these folks, though— these are people who live in red America, and only half of them feel confident that the Democratic nominee will win right now.
That sounds about right. Incumbent presidents get reelected. This guy has shown the ability to win once and now has the apparatus of incumbency and a bigger campaign and an economy that in some measurements is certainly not in recession.
Sure. Right?
So if I had to guess, it's going to take a very good campaign and a very good candidate to win.
I mean, I think that's a pretty well-informed perspective. I would say that I don't expect to see rank-and-file Democratic primary voters kind of have the same level of context that we're able to bring to bear in a conversation like this, but clearly they're processing information from a lot of different sources. What they tell us more often than not is that they see how animated Trump's base is all around them. This is actually worth comparing. When I'm in more progressive enclaves, especially on the coast, there's just a presumption that this guy's a clown and whoever will do to beat him. And so there is a bit of a divide there.
Yes.
So on that end of the spectrum, the thing that's driving people is how to beat Trump.
Yeah.
In the middle of the spectrum, what I find, I think, really awesome for me, and I'm completely self-interested, so is that a kind of progressive economic agenda is where the most intensity is.
Is that an intensity in the activist community? Or is that, where is that intensity located, would you say?
Yeah, so I'm sorry. So remember the membership breakdown that I talked about. So the 40% Democrats, 20% Republicans, and kind of everything else in between that 35 to 40% swing. You know, so there's some softies and kind of that range. The intensity in that mid-range is not from activists. These people are not activists by definition. They have weak political attachment. But where you say, okay, hair on fire demand is, yo, who's going to give me an economic break? Who's going to actually change the trajectory of what's happening in my community? And so if you come at it from that perspective, then you know that's where the intensity is. And so when we present people with, hey, wouldn't you care for, instead of having $2 trillion tax giveaway to the wealthiest corporations, to repeal that and reinvest that same type of resource in things like credits for purchasing durable American-made goods, investment in reduction of class size, expansion of healthcare facilities, bringing down cost of prescription drugs, like these really kind of very aggressive economic policy postures. You see a lot of demand for that. More gratifying to me from a labor perspective is where you also see some growing intensity that I hadn't seen in years is around access to collective bargaining. You know, when we ask people, if you had a chance to join a union on your job today, would you take that chance? And you see something of a predictable partisan distribution, like Republicans are more like to say no, and Democrats are more like to say yes. Once you get beneath that and you can control for partisanship a little bit more, what you're seeing is what, 2 out of 5 Trump voters, for example, in Western Pennsylvania and Northeastern Ohio tell us that they'd like to join a union. Like, you don't really think of...
No, that's a surprising statistic, frankly.
Yeah. And so that's from, a field survey of just around 1,200 individuals.
Do you think that the current crop of candidates are speaking to this preference that you're seeing out there for that kind of policy? Are you hearing that generally?
Are they speaking to it is one question. Are the voters hearing it yet is something I'm a bit more authoritative on. The answer is no, the voters in these parts of the country aren't hearing it yet, but the candidates, quite frankly, haven't begun to spend their resources in communicating with and to these voters. They're concentrated in the early 4 states. Donald Trump is speaking to these voters because what else does he have to do?
What do you think that he's saying is being most effective at reaching working America type folks?
Saying something is better than saying nothing. You know, he's done quite a bit to try to promote his renegotiated NAFTA deal. I think the labor movement's been clear that this isn't good enough.
Do you think it is an improvement politically? Like, do you think he scored points with that?
I think there are some real deficits. I mean, he certainly scored points going into the 2016 election because he had a real clear contrast. For, 3 decades, the labor movement has been telling both union members and community that these terrible trade deals have been one of the drivers in deindustrialization and wage pressures. And so you then step into that with, a candidate who, Hillary Clinton gets the blame for what all Democrats did and didn't do in 2016. She is the most visible example, but this was up and down the ticket. So this was, a broad indictment. But the embodiment of, TPP is the gold standard before, saying maybe not so much, versus someone who is clearer and unequivocal and says, China is sticking it to you and we've got a trade problem with Mexico and so forth.
He picked up an area where the Republican Party was not and where there was, which helped him really make inroads.
He did. But it's fascinating because people know how they eat. you really have to appreciate the intellect of the American voter. We were on the ground in the Pennsylvania 18 special election with Connor Lamb, and I loved this race. Trump comes in sensing that things aren't going his direction, and he announces the steel tariffs. And we had been tracking Trump approval, which was predictive of a vote choice for the Republicans to cone. Trump approval had started off around 40% in this district. Unfortunately, the Parkland shooting happens, and he suggests arming teachers as a solution. So that doesn't even fly in that district, and he drops into the mid-20s. He announces these tariffs, and his approval ratings skyrocket, and so does the Republican vote, and we're at around 50%. This thing isn't looking good. But then, after around 3 or 4 days, it starts to taper back down to the mid-30s. And you're asking people, what's going on? And they're saying, you know, the type of steel he's talking about imposing on tariffs, we don't make that type of steel here. People get to a real specific degree the details here. He is not going to pull the wool over anyone's eyes when it comes to NAFTA. Any of these trade deals, he's going to actually have to make sure are on point with what the concerns are of workers in the region.
To take immigration, the other big arrow in his quiver, at least as he sees it, how does that play among working America folk?
Sure. Our members are part of the overall populace. And so we did a test last cycle where we ran a control treat design, and a set of members were getting exposure from us on healthcare messaging, and a set were just exposed to the broader communications environment. Trump starts talking about the criminal gangs, caravans, etc. And you see this massive shift in opinion from the non-treated population towards immigration as their top concern. And if you're an immigration voter, then you tend to be far more conservative. But if they were getting communications from us, then they stayed on our issue, health care. The point is that if you give someone an explanation of their circumstances, then they can have a more sophisticated analysis. But if they're not getting anything, and all the only way they're going to consume information is through, you know, kind of word of mouth and local television, then so he wins that.
There seems to be a little bit implicit suggestion you're making there, but make it explicit. What should we be doing to combat that kind of messaging coming out of Trump?
One, call it what it is. I mean, it's just simple race baiting. But people who can relate to the sentiment aren't all enraged racists. You know, there's a difference between red hat wearing MAGA T-shirt lovers and people who are kind of just the kindling wood for the hot coals of racism. The people who are the kindling wood for hot coals of racism see, hey, employment is flat, wages are down. If I live in small town America, my probability of being employed is around 15% lower. Like, you see all of that stuff. What Democrats can and should consider doing is actually having meaningful policies that speak to that set of issues, but then speak to those voters and say, you know, you've got a reason to be frustrated. We have a globalized economy that has short-sighted you. But if you really think hard about it, the GM plant in Lordstown did not close because there were Mexican immigrants there. The GM plant in Lordstown is closing because you have corporate chiefs who are taking advantage of tax incentives that they helped enact to offshore and get a payout.
You know, you're coming at it, obviously, with a lot of years of experience and a lot of
debt. Are you saying I'm old?
No. You're a lot younger than me. So definitely not. But obviously, you've thought about this stuff a lot. What is driving you to make this your career? You don't just idly become, you know, sit for over a decade as political director and executive director of Working America. What's inside you that makes this important?
That's a great question. I don't know that I've thought about it. I think it's just my identity.
Well, tell me a little bit about how you grew up and how you, and the kind of the path that you took to this as a career and a vocation.
I mean, I've always grown up a working class kid. My father's a retired journalist. My mother's a retired teacher. Growing up in the 70s and 80s and so forth and bouncing around a lot, that's one of the virtues of having a journalist father is like being a military brat. You go from location to location. I got to see a lot of America, but I also got to just kind of see myself in a lot of America. And whether I was in New Jersey or DC or Mobile, Alabama or Atlanta, working class issues are all the same. And working class people especially being in the Deep South, like in Alabama in the late 70s, it's really easy to see a lot of white working class people who share the same neighborhood, the same restaurants, not the same churches as working class black folks. And you kind of see what the legacy of our economic system has wrought. So my orientation around economics has always been central. Both my parents were union members, but I don't know that that was central in my ideological formation. And then just living, man, you know, the rent's too damn high. And so the more you lend a critical and thoughtful eye to the world around you, the more you see this isn't cool. And you have a choice of trying to change it or trying to survive it. And I've tried to choose both.
What was your educational path?
So I went to Washington University in St. Louis for both undergraduate and law school, and I actually thought I wanted to be a tax lawyer, not a corporate tax lawyer, but I mean, and I guess it speaks to why I became somewhat of a self-taught quant later on in life. I've always just appreciated the kind of geometric shape of the tax code as opposed to kind of the murky stuff of constitutional law. I went on to work for Eleanor Holmes Norton, the congresswoman from D.C., for a few years before going on to work at AFT, the American Federation of Teachers, in the federal.
Well, what took you to AFT after Holmes Norton? Like, what was it, just a job opportunity, or were you seeking to move into labor? How did that happen?
It was really just kind of accidental. Okay. One of the virtues of working on the Hill is that you work really hard, get a lot of exposure. But one of the virtues of working on the Hill is you work really hard. You know, it's not the most lucrative career ever. And so with a lot of law school debt and a few years of really just, you know, 80-hour weeks, I was like, okay, maybe I can try something different. So I started looking to see what was an ideological fit. And there was an opening at the teachers. And so I said, oh, well, let's see how this works. And even in early conversations before I took the job, I could see, okay, ideologically, what these folks are advocating for is, you know, collective bargaining for access to affordable health care, for secure retirements, for one of the really few forces, if you think about it, that advocates for investment in racial and social equity in our education system and in public education. So I was like, sure.
And what was the job there that you had there?
I was in the federal affairs shop, and so that meant that I lobbied on a range of issues, labor law, Bureau of Indian Affairs, special education, kind of a bit of a potpourri, but I also went and did campaigns.
What do you think of the head of the AFT right now?
Randy?
Yeah.
I think she's
Her earlier on the podcast. I thought she was great, but what do you think of her in her space in the progressive ecosystem?
So, I mean, I think at a personal level, I have to observe that I don't think she sleeps. I think at a kind of strategic position, these teacher strikes have really been fascinating to
her. I know she was traveling all over with them. Yeah.
I mean, and they've got a video on their website that is, I work in this business, I'm not easily moved, that like you really see the beauty of what was constructed. And the way she describes it, I think, is really a credit to her, because it's easy for any leader to say, oh, yeah, I was sitting back here masterminding this brilliant thing. Yeah. Sometimes you just have to read what way the winds are blowing and know how to capture that momentum. And this is long-growing frustration with a austerity agenda. By channeling that and creating real partnerships and sharing models across jurisdictions of what community and teachers look like. And so, for example, one of the great stories out of West Virginia is that what made the teacher strikes initially successful is that the bus drivers joined in.
Mm, yes.
If you don't have the bus drivers, the kids can't get anywhere. Yeah. And so
you have a lot of impact very quickly.
Exactly. Yeah. Helping foment that type of massive resistance on kind of a more localized scale. I think one of the least told labor successes in recent history is the federal government shutdown. As much pain as that inflicted on so many people unnecessarily, what brought that to a grinding halt was a number of air traffic controllers in one of the major transit hubs in the globe being sick because they were unpaid for a month and a half and stressed. But it goes to show you the tactical power of what this type of movement building can do. And so I think Randy's pretty remarkable in that sense.
How did you originally come to Working America? How did that happen?
I've been at AFT for, 7 years almost? And I was like, all right, I want to try something different in life. And a friend of mine was the political director for John Edwards' presidential campaign in the 2007-08 cycle. And so I find a opportunity to be part of that campaign after the primary, rather than kind of do the traditional thing of jumping onto whoever the nominee's campaign was going to be. I wanted to return home to labor, but I wanted something that was dynamic and more campaign-oriented. And so I'd been searching around, and I came across this whole new concept called Working America, where it was a lot more kind of a physical field apparatus that year-round is doing this organizing mechanism. And I thought, oh, this is a great place to do politics. So I get here, and you know, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, I've learned a lot. I know a lot.
You came in as political director?
I came in as political director. I was certain that I knew everything because, you know, what young political director doesn't think she or he knows everything when they step into a job? And so I step into the job, and it was eye-opening. My first day on the job, everyone who works here has to canvass. Like, you have to go in the doors. You have to see what it's all about. Yeah. And I saw something I'd never seen before. I mean, I've worked on dozens of elections all around the country. And the organizing model and the canvas organizing interaction itself was just fundamentally different. Mm. The level of productivity and consistency, the standardization of it, it was just like, wow, what have I been sleeping on all these years? Mm-hmm. You know, my personal development in this space then took on trying to understand, all right, what about the mechanism works? How many of those door knocks do you need? How many conversations do you need? What does the wrap length need to be, et cetera? And that began with tinkering.
So you could really start to study what you were doing.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so through that tinkering kind of studying and evaluation process, I became more clear on the unique impact of what the organizing model was achieving in just in politics, and started to study the different components of it. And so now I think we've wound up some years later with a comprehensive analysis of how the organizing tools work in politics and in the economy. And ultimately, like, we're not fighting on one front. We're fighting on an economic front as well. So the ability to change economic behavior the same way we change voting behavior is really valuable.
What's different about being ED now than being political director for all those years?
When I got the job, I thought, oh, all right, I'll be, you know, adjacent to the executive director. I'll like a good perspective. Oh, yeah, I got this. I know what it is. Yeah. And it is totally different, of course. I started off, like I think a lot of EDs do, thinking, all right, let's try to do the thing that got me here and do more of that. Mm-hmm. And then when that wasn't kind of broad enough, I started to think, well, what would my predecessor have done? Because she was my mentor for a decade.
Yeah. Who was that?
Karen Nussbaum, the founder and director.
Who you mentioned earlier, yeah.
But it wasn't long after that that I realized 20 years from now, what will I have achieved having sat in this chair? Yeah. And it forced a clarity of vision.
There's a difference between working in something and working on something.
Yeah. Right?
You know, but like stepping outside and getting to the strategic, the big, rather than the tactical stuff. It's different.
But also having enough grounding in the tactical to know what's real and what's doable and what's not.
They're lucky they could hire from within for the ED, right?
I appreciate you saying that. I don't plan on going anywhere anytime ever. But
that's having, a long time, but yeah.
But, you know, having been through the process and knowing what it means to have that type of continuity, but also a different division, like there are things that Karen and I just had a fundamentally different approach on.
Sure.
Now I understand her approach a lot better. And I also understand the importance of what it takes to build a team from within.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we've been fortunate in it that, you know, for a political organization, we have a pretty long tenure for a lot of folks. I mean, we've got field organizers who've been here longer than I have.
That's a good sign in general about an organization.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we've been able to retain all that knowledge and best practices.
Is there a question that I failed to ask that I should have?
I don't know if this is a question, but I'll kind of give my elevator wrap.
What's your elevator wrap?
Good question. This is not a time for small victories. As we look at what Donald Trump has brought, and more concerningly the global landscape, we need to be clear-eyed and very serious about what we're confronting. At the same time, this is an opportunity for the type of transformative election that we haven't seen since the early 80s, and in a real political realignment that just makes more sense for where the country is. In order to do that, I like our thing. I think it's awesome. Undoubtedly, I'm an advocate for it. But I think collectively, progressives need to be thoughtful with a learning posture, because we know enough about what works and how to make things work that we can not guess. We can kind of avoid having pet theories of change and instead focus on what's going to be the hard-nosed work that if we do this now, we never have a Donald Trump again. That's what keeps me up at night, and that's what lets me sleep well when I do sleep well, is knowing that I'm doing my best to try to contribute to that.
Well, I'm glad you're out there doing your best and helping in this direction. Anything else you want to say?
Well, I just want to say thank you for taking the time to listen, and I really appreciate your thoughtfulness, and this is fun.
Fun for me too. Thanks.
Thanks, brother.
That was Matt Morrison with Working America. He's at workingamerica.org. Listening to the hard-won expertise of people like Matt is key to moving the country in a progressive direction. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.